aftermath. Aragorn groaned and leaned back against Saphira. Bracing his hands on his knees, he slid down over her bumpy scales until he was sitting on the ground, then stretched out his legs in front of him. "I'm hungry," he exclaimed. He and Saphira were in the courtyard of the castle, away from the men who were labouring to clear it, piling stones and bodies alike into carts, and from the people streaming in and out of the damaged building, many of whom had been present at Nasuada's audience with King Halfpaw, and were now leaving to attend to other duties. Blodgarm and four elves stood nearby, watching for danger.
"Oi!"
someone shouted. Aragorn looked up to see Roran walking toward him from the keep. Angela trailed a few steps behind, yarn flapping in the air, as she half ran to keep up with his longer stride. "Where are you off to now?" Aragorn asked, as Roran stopped before him.
"To help secure the city and organize the prisoners."
"Ah." Aragorn's gaze wandered across the busy courtyard before returning to Roran's bruised face. "You fought well."
"You too."
Aragorn shifted his attention to Angela, who was once again knitting, her fingers moving so quickly he could not follow what she was doing.
"Cheap, cheap?" he asked.
An impish expression overtook her face, and she shook her head, her voluminous curls bouncing.
"A story for another time."
Aragorn accepted her evasion without complaint. He had not expected her to explain herself. She rarely did.
"And you," said Roran, "where are you going?"
"We're going to get some food," said Saphira,
and nudged Aragorn with her snout, her breath warm on him as she exhaled. Roran nodded.
"That sounds best. I'll see you at camp this evening, then."
As he turned to leave, he added,
"Give my love to Katrina."
Angela tucked her knitting into a quilted bag that hung at her waist.
"I guess I'll be off as well. I have a potion brewing in my tent that I must attend to. And there's a certain weircat I want to track down."
"Grimmer?"
No, an old friend of mine. Solombum's mother. If she's still alive, that is. I hope she is."
She raised her hand to her brow, thumb and forefinger touching in a circle, and in an overly cheerful voice said,
"Be seeing you."
And with that, she sailed off.
"On my back,"
said Saphira, and rose to her feet, leaving Aragorn without support. He climbed into the saddle at the base of her neck, and Saphira unfolded her massive wings with the soft, dry sound of skin sliding over skin. The motion created a gust of near-silent wind that spread out like ripples in a pond. Throughout the courtyard, people paused to look at her. As Saphira lifted her wings overhead, Aragorn could see the web of purplish veins that pulsed therein, each one becoming a hollow worm track as the flow of blood subsided between the beats of her mighty heart. Then with a surge and a jolt, the world tilted crazily around Aragorn as Saphira jumped from the courtyard to the top of the castle wall, where she balanced for a moment on the merlins, the stones cracking between the points of her claws. He grabbed the next spike in front of him to steady himself. The world tilted again as Saphira launched herself off the wall. An acrid taste and smell assaulted Aragorn, and his eyes smarted as Saphira passed through the thick layer of smoke that hung over Bellatona, like a blanket of hurt, anger, and sorrow. Saphira flapped twice, hard, and then they emerged from the smoke into the sunshine and soared over the fire-dotted streets of the city. Stilling her wings, Saphira glided in circles, allowing the warm air from below to lift her ever higher. Tired as he was, Aragorn savoured the magnificence of the view. The growling storm that was about to swallow the whole of Bellatona glowed white and brilliant along its leading edge, while farther away the Thunderhead wallowed in inky shadows that betrayed nothing of their contents, save when bolts of lightning shot through them. Elsewhere, the gleaming lake and the hundreds of small verdant farms that were scattered across the landscape also commanded his attention, but none were so impressive as the mountain of clouds. As always, Aragorn felt privileged to be able to look upon the world from so high above, for he was aware of how few people had ever had the chance to fly on a dragon. With a slight shift of her wings, Sephira began to glide down toward the rows of grey tents that composed the Varden's camp. A strong wind sprang up from the west, heralding the imminent arrival of the storm. Aragorn hunched over and wrapped his hands even more securely around the spike on her neck. He saw glossy ripples race across the fields below as the stalks bent under the force of the rising gale. The shifting grass reminded him of the fur of a great green beast. A horse screamed as Sephira swept over the rows of tents to the clearing that was reserved for her. Aragorn half stood in the saddle as Sephira flared her wings and slowed to a near standstill over the torn earth. The impact as she struck knocked Aragorn forward.
"Sorry," she said. "I tried to land as softly as I could."
"I know." Even as he dismounted, Aragorn saw Katrina hurrying toward him. Her long auburn hair swirled about her face as she walked across the clearing, and the press of the wind exposed the bulge of her growing belly through the layers of her dress. "What news?" she called, worry etched into every line of her face. "You heard about the Weircats?" She nodded. "There's no real news other than that. Roran's fine. He said to give you his love." Her expression softened, but her worry did not entirely disappear. "He's all right, then?" She motioned toward the ring she wore on the third finger of her left hand, one of the two rings Aragorn had enchanted for her and Roran, so they might know if one or the other was in danger. "I thought I felt something about an hour ago, and I was afraid that..." Aragorn shook his head. "Roran can tell you about it. He got a few nicks and bruises, but other than that, he's fine. Scared me half to death, though." Katrina's look of concern intensified. Then, with visible struggle, she smiled. "At least you're safe, both of you." They parted, and Aragorn and Sephira made their way to one of the mess tents close to the Varden's cookfires. There they gorged themselves on meat and mead, while the wind howled around them, and bursts of rain pummeled the sides of the flapping tent. As Aragorn bit into a slab of roast pork belly, Sephira said,
"Is it good? Is it scrumptious?"
said Aragorn, rivulets of juice running down his chin. Memories of the Dead. Galbatorix is mad, and therefore unpredictable. But he also has gaps in his reasoning that an ordinary person would not. If you can find those, Aragorn, then perhaps you and Sephira can defeat him. Brom lowered his pipe, his face grave. "I hope you do. My greatest desire, Aragorn, is that you and Sephira will live long and fruitful lives, free from fear of Galbatorix and the Empire. I wish that I could protect you from all of the dangers that threaten you, but alas, that is not within my ability. All I can do is give you my advice and teach you what I can now, while I am still here. My son, whatever happens to you, know that I love you, and so did your mother. May the stars watch over you, Aragorn Bromson." Aragorn opened his eyes as the memory faded. Above him, the ceiling of the tent sagged inward, as loose as an empty water skin after the battering it had received during the now-departed storm. A drop of water fell from the belly of a fold, struck his right thigh, and soaked through his leggings, chilling the skin beneath. He knew he would have to go tighten up the tent support ropes, but he was reluctant to move from the cot.
"And Brom never said anything to you about Murtagh? He never told you that Murtagh and I were half-brothers?"
Sephira, who was curled up outside the tent, said,
"Asking again won't change my answer."
"Why wouldn't he, though? Why didn't he? He must have known about Murtagh. He couldn't not have."
Sephira's response was slow to come.
"Brom's reasons were ever his own, but if I had to guess, I imagine he thought it more important to tell you how he cared for you, and to give you what advice he could, than to spend his time talking about Murtag.
He could have warned me, though. Just a few words would have sufficed.
I cannot say for certain what drove him, Eragon. You have to accept that there are some questions you will never be able to answer about Brom. Trust in his love for you, and do not allow such concerns to disturb you.
Eragon stared down his chest at his thumbs. He placed them side by side to better compare them. His left thumb had more wrinkles on its second joint than did his right, while his right had a small ragged scar that he could not remember getting, although it must have happened since the Agaiti Blodron, the Blood Oath celebration.
"Thank you," he said to Saphira. Through her, he had watched and listened to Brom's message 3 times since the fall of Feinster, and each time he had noticed some detail of Brom's speech or movement that had previously escaped him. The experience comforted and satisfied him, for it fulfilled a desire that had plagued him his entire life, to know the name of his father and to know that his father cared for him. Saphira acknowledged his thanks with a warm glow of affection. Though Eragon had eaten and then rested for perhaps an hour, his weariness had not entirely abated, nor had he expected it to. He knew from experience that it could take weeks to fully recover from the debilitating effects of a long, drawn-out battle. As the Varden approached Urabane, he and everyone else in Nasawada's army would have less and less time to recover before each new confrontation. The war would wear them down until they were bloody, battered, and barely able to fight, at which point they would still have to face Galbatorix, who would have been waiting for them in ease and comfort. He tried not to think about it too much. Another drop of water struck his leg, cold and hard. Irritated, he swung his legs off the edge of the cot and sat upright, then went over to the bare patch of dirt in one corner and knelt next to it. "Deloi shalavi," he said, as well as several other phrases in the ancient language that were necessary to disarm the traps he had set the previous day. The dirt began to seethe like water coming to a boil, and rising out of the churning fountain of rocks, insects, and worms, there emerged an iron-bound chest 1.5 feet in length. Reaching out, Eragon took hold of the chest and released his spell. The ground grew calm once more. He set the chest on the now solid dirt. "Laedren," he whispered,
and waved his hand past the lock with no keyhole that secured the hasp. It popped open with a click. A faint golden glow filled the tent as he lifted the lid of the chest. Nestled securely within the velvet-lined interior lay Glader's Eldunari, the dragon's heart of hearts. The large jewel-like stone glittered darkly, like a dying ember. Eragon cupped the Eldunari between his hands, the irregular, sharp-edged facets warm against his palms, and stared into its pulsing depths. A galaxy of tiny stars swirled within the center of the stone, although their movement had slowed, and there seemed to be far fewer than when Eragon had first beheld the stone in Ella's mirror, when Glader had discharged it from his body and into Eragon and Saphira's care. As always, the sight fascinated Eragon. He could have sat watching the ever-changing pattern for days.
"We should try again," said Saphira,
and he agreed. Together, they reached out with their minds toward the distant lights, toward the sea of stars that represented Glader's consciousness. Through cold and darkness they sailed, then heat and despair and indifference, so vast and so great, it sapped their will to do anything other than to stop and weep.
"Glader! Elder!" they cried over and over.
But there was no answer, no shifting of the indifference. At last they withdrew, unable to withstand the crushing weight of Glada's misery any longer. As he returned to himself, Aragorn became aware of someone knocking on the front pole of his tent, and then he heard Arya say, "Aragorn, may I enter?" He sniffed and blinked to clear his eyes. "Of course." The dim grey light from the cloudy sky fell upon him as Arya pushed aside the entrance flap. He felt a sudden pang as his eyes met hers, green, slanted and unreadable, and an ache of longing filled him. "Has there been any change?" she asked, and came to kneel by him. Instead of armour, she was wearing the same black leather shirt, trousers and thin-soled boots as when he had rescued her in Gilead. Her hair was damp from washing and hung down her back in long, heavy ropes. The scent of crushed pine needles attended her, as it so often did, and it occurred to Aragorn to wonder whether she used a spell to create the aroma, or if that was how she smelled naturally. He would have liked to ask her, but he did not dare. In answer to her question, he shook his head. "May I?" She indicated Glada's heart of hearts. He moved out of the way. "Please." Arya placed her hands on either side of the Eldonari and then closed her eyes. While she sat, he took the opportunity to study her with an openness and intensity that would have been offensive otherwise. In every aspect, she seemed the epitome of beauty, even though he knew that another might say her nose was too long, or her face too angled, or her ears too pointed, or her arms too muscled. With a sharp intake of breath, Arya jerked her hands away from the Heart of Hearts as if it had burned her. Then she bowed her head, and Aragorn saw her chin quiver ever so faintly. "He is the most unhappy creature I have ever met. I would we could help him. I do not think he will be able to find his way out of the darkness on his own." "Do you think?" Aragorn hesitated, not wanting to give voice to his suspicion, then continued, "Do you think he will go mad? He may have already. If not, then he dances on the very cusp of insanity." Sorrow came over Aragorn as they both gazed at the golden stone. When at last he was able to bring himself to speak again, he asked, "Where is the Dauthdert?" "Hidden within my tent, even as you have hidden Glada's Eldonari. I can bring it here if you want, or I can continue to safeguard it until you need it."
"Keep it. I can't carry it around with me, or Galbatorix may learn of its existence. Besides, it would be foolish to store so many treasures in one place." She nodded. The ache inside of Aragorn intensified.
"Arya, I..."
He stopped, as Saphira saw one of the blacksmith Horst's sons, Albreg, he thought, although it was difficult to tell him from his brother Baldur, because of the distortions in Saphira's vision, running toward the tent. The interruption relieved Aragorn, as he had not known what he was going to say. "Someone's coming," he announced, and closed the lid of the chest. Loud, wet footsteps sounded in the mud outside. Then Albreg, for it was Albreg, shouted,
"Aragorn! Aragorn!"
"What?"
"Mother's birth pains have just begun. Father sent me to tell you, and to ask if you will wait with him in case anything goes wrong, and your skill with magic is needed. Please, if you can—"
Whatever else he said was lost to Aragorn, as he rushed to lock and bury the chest. Then he cast his cloak over his shoulders, and was fumbling with the clasp, when Arya touched him on the arm and said,
"May I accompany you? I have some experience with this. If your people will let me, I can make the birth easier for her."
Aragorn did not even pause to consider his decision. He motioned toward the entrance of the tent. "After you." What is a man? The mud clung to Roran's boots each time he lifted his feet, slowing his progress and making his already tired legs burn from the effort. It felt as if the very ground were trying to pull off his shoes. Thick as it was, the mud was also slippery. It gave way under his heels at the worst moments, just when his position was the most precarious. And it was deep, too. The constant passage of men, animals, and wagons
had turned the top 6 inches of earth into a nigh-on impassable morass. A few patches of crushed grass remained along the edges of the track, which ran straight through the Varden's camp, but Roran suspected they would soon vanish as men sought to avoid the centre of the lane. Roran made no attempt to evade the muck. He no longer cared if his clothes stayed clean. Besides, he was so exhausted it was easier to keep plodding in the same direction than to worry about picking a path from one island of grass to the next. As he stumbled forward, Roran thought of Bellatona. Since Nasawada's audience with the Weircats, he had been setting up a command post in the northwest quarter of the city, and doing his best to establish control over the quadrant by assigning men to put out fires, build barricades in the streets, search houses for soldiers, and confiscate weapons. It was an immense task, and he despaired of accomplishing what was needed, fearing that the city might erupt into open battle again. "I hope those idiots can make it through the night without getting killed." His left side throbbed, causing him to bare his teeth and suck in his breath. "Blasted coward!" Someone had shot at him with a crossbow from the roof of a building. Only the sheerest of luck had saved him. One of his men, Mortensen, had stepped in front of him at the exact moment the attacker had fired. The bolt had punched through Mortensen from back to belly, and had still retained enough force to give Roran a nasty bruise. Mortensen had died on the spot. Whoever had shot the crossbow had escaped. 5 minutes later, an explosion of some sort, possibly magical, had killed two more of his men when they entered a stable to investigate a noise. From what Roran understood, such attacks were common throughout the city. No doubt Galbatorix's agents were behind many of them, but the inhabitants of Bellatona were also responsible. Men and women who could not bear to stand idly by while an invading army seized control of their home, no matter how honourable the Varden's intentions might be. Roran could sympathise with the people who felt they had to defend their families, but at the same time he cursed them for being so thick-skulled that they could not recognise the Varden were trying to help them, not hurt them. He scratched at his beard while he waited for a dwarf to pull a heavily laden pony out of his way, then continued slogging forward. As he drew near their tent, he saw Katrina standing over a tub of hot soapy water, scrubbing a blood-stained bandage against a washboard. Her sleeves were rolled up past her elbows, her hair tied in a messy bun, and her cheeks flushed from her work. But she had never looked so beautiful to him. She was his comfort and his refuge, and just seeing her helped ease the sense of numb dislocation that gripped him. She noticed him, and immediately abandoned her washing and ran toward him, drying her pink hands on the front of her dress. Roran braced himself as she threw herself at him, wrapping her arms around his chest. His side flared with pain, and he uttered a short grunt. Katrina loosened her hold and leaned away, frowning.
"Oh, did I hurt you?"
"No, no, I'm just sore." She did not question him, but hugged him again, more gently, and looked up at him, her eyes glistening with tears. Holding her by the waist, he bent and kissed her, inexpressibly grateful for her presence. Katrina slipped his left arm over her shoulders, and he allowed her to support part of his weight as they returned to their tent. With a sigh, Roran sat on the stump they used for a chair, which Katrina had placed next to the small fire she had built to heat the tub of water, and over which a pot of stew was now simmering. Katrina filled a bowl with stew and handed it to him. Then from within the tent, she brought him a mug of ale and a plate with a half loaf of bread and a wedge of cheese.
"Is there anything else you need?" she asked, her voice unusually hoarse.
Roran did not answer, but cupped her cheek and stroked it twice with his thumb. She smiled tremulously and laid a hand over his, then returned to washing and began to scrub with renewed vigour. Roran stared at the food for a long time before he took a bite. He was still so tense he doubted he could stomach it. After a few mouthfuls of bread, however, his appetite returned, and he began to consume the stew with eagerness. When he was done, he placed the dishes on the ground, and then sat warming his hands over the fire while he nursed the last few sips of beer.
"We heard the crash when the gates fell," said Katrina, wringing a bandage dry. "They didn't hold for very long."
"No,
It helps to have a dragon on your side.
Roran gazed at her belly as she draped the bandage over the makeshift clothesline that ran from the peak of their tent across to a neighbouring one. Whenever he thought of the child she was carrying, the child that the two of them had created, he felt an enormous sense of pride. But it was tinged with anxiety, for he did not know how he could hope to provide a safe home for their baby. Also, if the war was not over by the time Katrina gave birth, she intended to leave him and go to Cirda, where she might raise their child in relative safety.
I can't lose her, not again.
Katrina immersed another bandage in the tub.
And the battle in the city?
She asked, churning the water.
How went it?
We had to fight for every foot. Even Aragorn had a hard time of it.
The wounded spoke of ballistae mounted on wheels.
Aye.
Roran wet his tongue with ale, then quickly described how the Varden had moved through Bellatona, and the setbacks they had encountered along the way.
We lost too many men today, but it could have been worse, much worse. Jormungandr and Captain Martland planned the attack well.
Their plan wouldn't have worked, though, if not for you and Aragorn. You acquitted yourself most bravely.
Roran loosed a single bark of laughter.
Ha! And do you know why that is?
I'll tell you. Not one man in 10 is actually willing to attack the enemy. Aragorn doesn't see it. He's always at the forefront of the battle, driving the soldiers before him, but I see it. Most of the men hang back and don't fight unless they're cornered, or they wave their arms about and make a lot of noise, but don't actually do anything.
Katrina looked appalled. How can that be? Are they cowards? I don't know. I think that perhaps they just can't bring themselves to look a man in the face and kill him. Although it seems easy enough for them to cut down soldiers whose backs are turned. So they wait for others to do what they cannot. They wait for people like me.
Do you think Galbatorix's men are equally reluctant?
Roran shrugged. They might be. But then they have no choice but to obey Galbatorix. If he orders them to fight, they fight.
Nasawada could do the same. She could have her magicians cast spells to ensure that no one shirks their duty.
What difference would there be between her and Galbatorix, then? In any case, the Varden wouldn't stand for it.
Katrina left her washing to come and kiss him on the forehead.
I'm glad you can do what you do, she whispered.
She returned to the tub and began scrubbing another strip of soiled linen over the washboard.
I felt something earlier from my ring. I thought maybe something had happened to you.
I was in the middle of a battle. It wouldn't be surprising if you had felt a twinge every few minutes.
She paused with her arms in the water.
I never have before.
He drained the mug of ale, seeking to delay the inevitable. He had hoped to spare her the details of his misadventure in the castle, but it was plain that she would not rest until she knew the truth. Attempting to convince her otherwise would only lead her to imagine calamities far worse than what had actually occurred. Besides, it would be pointless for him to hold back, when news of the event would soon be common throughout the Varden. So he told her. He gave her a brief account, and tried to make the collapse of the wall seem more like a minor inconvenience, rather than something that had almost killed him. Still, he found it difficult to describe the experience, and he spoke haltingly, searching for the right words. When he finished, he fell silent, troubled by the remembrance.
At least you weren't hurt, said Katrina.
He picked at a crack in the lip of the mug. No. The sound of sloshing water ceased, and he could feel her eyes heavy upon him.
You faced far greater danger before.
Yes, I suppose. Her voice softened.
What's wrong, then?
When he did not answer, she said,
There's nothing so terrible you can't tell me, Roran. You know that.
The edge of his right thumbnail tore as he picked at the mug again. He rubbed the sharp flap against his forefinger several times.
I thought I was going to die when the wall fell. Anyone might have. Yes, but the thing is, I didn't mind.
Anguished, he looked at her.
Don't you understand? I gave up. When I realized I couldn't escape, I accepted it as meekly as a lamb led to slaughter, and I...
Unable to continue, He dropped the mug and hid his face in his hands. The swelling in his throat made it hard to breathe. Then he felt Katrina's fingers light upon his shoulders.
"I gave up,"
he growled, furious and disgusted with himself.
"I just stopped fighting for you, for our child."
He choked on the words.
"Shh, shh,"
she murmured.
"I've never given up before, not once, not even when the Razak took you."
"I know you haven't.
This fighting has to end. It can't go on like this. I can't.
He raised his head and was horrified to see that she too was on the verge of tears. Standing, he wrapped his arms around her and held her close.
"I'm sorry," he whispered. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. It won't happen again. Never again, I promise."
"I don't care about that," she said, her voice muffled against his shoulder. Her reply stung him.
"I know I was weak, but my word still ought to be worth something to you."
"That's not what I meant," she exclaimed, and drew back to look at him accusingly.
"You're a fool sometimes, Roran."
He smiled slightly.
"I know."
She clasped her hands behind his neck.
"I wouldn't think any less of you, regardless of what you felt when the wall came down. All that matters is that you're still alive. There wasn't anything you could do when the wall fell, was there?"
He shook his head.
"Then you have nothing to be ashamed of. If you could have stopped it, or if you could have escaped but you didn't, then you would have lost my respect. But you did everything you could. And when you could do no more, you made peace with your fate. And you didn't rail needlessly against it. That is wisdom, not weakness."
He bowed and kissed her on the brow.
"Thank you. And as far as I am concerned, you are the bravest, strongest, kindest man in all of Alagasia."
This time he kissed her on the mouth. Afterward, she laughed, a short, quick release of pent-up tension. And they stood swaying together, as if dancing to a melody only they could hear. Then Katrina gave him a playful push and went to finish the washing, and he settled back on the stump, content for the first time since the battle, despite his numerous aches and pains. Roran watched the men, horses, and the occasional dwarf or Urgle slog past their tent, noting their wounds and the condition of their weapons and armor. He tried to gauge the general mood of the Varden. The only conclusion he reached was that everyone but the Urgles needed a good sleep and a decent meal, and that everyone, including the Urgles, especially the Urgles, needed to be scoured from head to foot with a hog's hair brush and buckets of soapy water. He also watched Katrina, and he saw how as she worked, her initial good cheer gradually faded, and she became ever more irritable. She kept scrubbing and scrubbing at several stains, but with little success. A scowl darkened her face, and she began to make small noises of frustration. At last, when she had slapped the wad of fabric against the washboard, splashing foamy water several feet into the air, and leaned on the tub, her lips pressed tightly together, Roran pushed himself off the stump and made his way to her side. "Here, let me," he said.
"It wouldn't be fitting," she muttered.
"Nonsense.
Go sit down and I'll finish. Go on."
She shook her head.
"No, you should be the one resting, not me. Besides, this isn't man's work."
He snorted with derision.
"By whose decree? A man's work or a woman's is whatever needs to be done. Now go sit down. You'll feel better once you're off your feet." "Roran, I'm fine. Don't be silly."
He gently tried to push her away from the tub, but she refused to budge.
"It's not right," she protested. "What would people think?"
She gestured at the men hurrying along the muddy lane next to their tent.
"They can think whatever they want. I married you, not them. If they believe I'm any less of a man for helping you, then they're fools."
But
nothing. Move. Shoo. Get out of here."
"But..." "I'm not going to argue.
If you don't go sit, I'm going to carry you over there and tie you to that stump."
A bemused expression replaced her scowl.
"Is that so?"
"Yes. Now go."
As she reluctantly ceded her position at the tub, he made a noise of exasperation.
"Stubborn, aren't you?
Speak for yourself. You could teach a mule a thing or two."
"Not me. I'm not stubborn."
Undoing his belt, he removed his mail shirt and hung it on the front pole of the tent, then peeled off his gloves and rolled up the sleeves of his tunic. The air was cool against his skin, and the bandages were colder still. They had grown chill while lying exposed on the washboard. But he did not mind, for the water was warm, and soon the cloth was as well. Frothy mounds of iridescent bubbles built up around his wrists as he pushed and pulled the material across the full length of the knobby board. He glanced over and was pleased to see that Katrina was relaxing on the stump, at least as much as anyone could relax on such a rough seat.
"Do you want some chamomile tea?" she asked. "Gertrude gave me a handful of fresh sprigs this morning. I can make a pot for both of us."
"I'd like that." A companionable silence developed between them, as Roran proceeded to wash the rest of the laundry. The task lulled him into a pleasant mood. He enjoyed doing something with his hands, other than swinging his hammer, and being close to Katrina gave him a deep sense of satisfaction. He was in the middle of wringing out the last item, and his freshly poured tea was waiting for him next to Katrina, when someone shouted their names from across the busy way. It took Roran a moment to realize it was Baldur running toward them through the mud, weaving between men and horses. He wore a pitted leather apron and heavy elbow-length gloves that were smeared with soot and were so worn that the fingers were as hard, smooth and shiny as polished tortoise shells. A scrap of torn leather held back his dark, shaggy hair, and a frown creased his forehead. Baldur was smaller than his father, Horst, and his older brother, Albrecht, but by any other comparison he was large and well-muscled, the result of having spent his childhood helping Horst in his forge. None of the three had fought that day. Skilled smiths were normally too valuable to risk in battle, although Roran wished Nasuada had let them, for they were able warriors, and Roran knew he could count on them, even in the most dire circumstances. Roran put down the washing and dried his hands, wondering what could be amiss. Rising from the stump, Katrina joined him by the tub. When Baldur reached them, they had to wait several seconds for him to regain his breath. Then in a rush, he said, "Come quickly! Mother just went into labour and—"
"Where is she?"
asked Katrina in a sharp tone.
"At our tent."
She nodded.
"We'll be there as fast as we can."
With a grateful expression, Baldur turned and sprinted away. As Katrina ducked inside their tent, Roran poured the contents of the tub over the fire, extinguishing it. The burning wood hissed and cracked under the deluge, and a cloud of steam jetted upward in place of smoke, filling the air with an unpleasant smell. Dread and excitement quickened Roran's movements.
"I hope she doesn't die,"
he thought, remembering the talk he had heard among the women concerning her age and overlong pregnancy. Elaine had always been kind to him and to Aragorn, and he was fond of her.
"Are you ready?"
asked Katrina as she emerged from the tent, knotting a blue scarf around her head and neck. He grabbed his belt and hammer from where they hung.
"Ready. Let's go." The Price of Power.
"There now, ma'am. You won't be needing these any more. And good riddance, I say."
With a soft rustle, the last strip of linen slid off Nasuada's forearms as her handmaid, Ferica, removed the wrappings. Nasuada had worn bandages such as those since the day she and the warlord Faduar had tested their courage against one another in the trial of the long knives. Nasuada stood staring at a long, ragged tapestry dotted with holes while Ferica attended to her. Then she steeled herself and slowly lowered her gaze. Since winning the trial of the long knives, she had refused to look at her wounds. They had appeared so horrendous when fresh, she could not bear to see them again until they were nearly healed. The scars were asymmetrical. 6 lay across the belly of her left forearm, 3 on her right. Each of the scars was 3 to 4 inches long and straight as could be, save the bottom one on the right, where her self-control had faltered and the knife had swerved, carving a jagged line nearly twice the length of the others. The skin around the scars was pink and puckered, while the scars themselves were only a little bit lighter than the rest of her body, for which she was grateful. She had feared that they might end up white and silvery, which would have made them far more noticeable. The scars rose above the surface of her arm about a quarter of an inch, forming hard ridges of flesh that looked exactly as if smooth steel rods had been inserted underneath her skin. Nasawada regarded the marks with ambivalence. Her father had taught her about the customs of their people as she was growing up, but she had spent her whole life among the Varden and the dwarfs. The only rituals of the wandering tribes that she observed, and then only irregularly, were associated with their religion. She had never aspired to master the drum dance, nor participate in the arduous calling of names, nor, and this most particularly, best anyone in the trial of the long knives. And yet now here she was, still young and still beautiful, and already bearing these 9 large scars upon her forearms. She could order one of the magicians of the Varden to remove them, of course, but then she would forfeit her victory in the trial of the long knives, and the wandering tribes would renounce her as their liegelord. While she regretted that her arms were no longer smooth and round, and would no longer attract the admiring glances of men, she was also proud of the scars. They were a testament to her courage, and a visible sign of her devotion to the Varden. Anyone who looked at her would know the quality of her character, and she decided that meant more to her than appearance. "What do you think?" she asked, and held out her arms toward King Orin, who stood framed in the open window of the study, looking down at the city. Orin turned and frowned, his eyes dark beneath his furrowed brow. He had traded his armor of earlier for a thick red tunic and a robe trimmed with white ermine. "I find it unpleasant to look at," he said, and returned his attention to the city. "Cover yourself. It is inappropriate for polite society." Nasawada studied her arms for a moment longer. "No, I don't think I will." She tugged on the lace cuffs of her half-sleeves to straighten them, then dismissed Verica. She crossed the sumptuous dwarf-woven rug in the center of the room to join Orin in inspecting the battle-torn city, where she was pleased to see that all but 2 of the fires along the western wall had been extinguished. Then she shifted her gaze to the king. In the short while since the Varden and the Serdans had launched their attack against the Empire, Nasawada had watched Orin grow ever more serious, his original enthusiasm and eccentricities vanishing beneath a grim exterior. At first she had welcomed the change, for she had felt he was becoming more mature. But as the war dragged on, she began to miss his eager discussions of natural philosophy, as well as his other quirks. In retrospect, she realized these had often brightened her day, even if she had sometimes found them aggravating. Moreover, the change had made him more dangerous as a rival. In his current mood, she could quite easily imagine him attempting to displace her as leader of the Varden. "Could I be happy if I married him?" she wondered. Orin was not unpleasant to look at. His nose was high and thin, but his jaw was strong, and his mouth was finely carved and expressive. Years of martial training had given him a pleasing build. That he was intelligent was without doubt, and for the most part his personality was agreeable. However, if he had not been the King of Cirda, and if he had not posed such a great threat to her position and to the Varden's independence, she knew that she would never have considered a match with him. Would he make a good father? Orin put his hands on the narrow stone sill and leaned against it. Without looking at her, he said, "You have to break your pact with the Urgles." His statement took her aback. "And why is that?" "Because they are hurting us. Men who would otherwise join us now curse us for allying ourselves with monsters, and refuse to lay down their weapons when we arrive at their homes. Galbatorix's resistance seems just and reasonable to them because of our concord with the Urgles. The common man does not understand why we joined with them. He does not know that Galbatorix used the Urgles himself, nor that Galbatorix tricked them into attacking Trondheim under the command of a Shade. These are subtleties that you cannot explain to a frightened farmer. All he can comprehend is that the creatures he has feared and hated his whole life are marching toward his home, led by a huge, snarling dragon, and a rider who appears more elf than human."
We need the Urgal's support, said Nasawada. We have too few warriors as it is.
We do not need them as badly as all that. You already know what I say is the truth. Why else did you prevent the Urgals from participating in the attack on Belatona? Why else have you ordered them not to enter the city? Keeping them away from the battlefield isn't enough, Nasawada. Word of them still spreads throughout the land. The only thing you can do to improve the situation is to end this ill-fated scheme before it causes us more harm.
I cannot.
Orin spun toward her, anger distorting his face.
Men are dying because you chose to accept Garjvarg's help. My men, your men, those in the Empire, dead and buried. This alliance isn't worth their sacrifice. And for the life of me, I cannot fathom why you continue to defend it.
She could not hold his gaze. It reminded her too strongly of the guilt and recrimination that so often afflicted her when she was trying to fall asleep. Instead, she fixed her eyes on the smoke rising from a tower by the edge of the city. Speaking slowly, she said,
I defend it, because I hope that preserving our union with the Urgals will save more lives than it will cost. If we should defeat Galbatorix...
Orin uttered an exclamation of disbelief.
It is by no means certain, she said. I know, but we must plan for the possibility. If we should defeat him, then it will fall to us to help our race recover from this conflict and build a strong new country out of the ashes of the Empire. And part of that process will be ensuring that after 100 years of strife, we finally have peace. I will not overthrow Galbatorix, only to have the Urgals attack us when we are at our weakest.
They might anyway. They always have before.
Well, what else can we do? She said, annoyed. We have to try to tame them. The closer we bind them to our cause, the less likely they will be to turn on us.
I'll tell you what to do, he growled. Banish them. Break your pact with Nargajvog and send him and his rams away. If we win this war, then we can negotiate a new treaty with them, and we will be in a position to dictate whatever terms we want. Or better yet, send Aragorn and Saphira into the spine with a battalion of men to wipe them out once and for all, as the riders should have done centuries ago.
Nasawada looked at him with disbelief.
If I ended our pact with the Urgals, they would likely be so angry they would attack us forthwith. And we cannot fight both them and the Empire at the same time. To invite that upon ourselves would be the height of folly. If, in their wisdom, the elves, the dragons, and the riders all decided to tolerate the existence of the Urgals, even though they could have destroyed them easily enough, then we ought to follow their example. They knew it would be wrong to kill all the Urgals, and so should you.
Their wisdom, bah! As if their wisdom has done them any good. Fine, leave some of the Urgals alive, but kill enough of them that they won't dare leave their haunts for 100 years or more.
The obvious pain in his voice and in the strained lines of his face puzzled Nasawada. She examined him with greater intensity, trying to determine the reason for his vehemence. After a few moments, an explanation presented itself that upon reflection seemed self-evident.
Whom did you lose? She asked.
Orin balled up a fist and slowly, haltingly, brought it down upon the windowsill, as if he wanted to pound it with all his strength, but did not dare. He thumped the sill twice more, then said,
A friend I grew up with in Boromeo Castle. I don't think you ever met him. He was one of the lieutenants in my cavalry.
How did he die?
As you might expect. We had just arrived at the stables by the west gate and were securing them for our own use, when one of the grooms ran out of a stall and stabbed him right through with a pitchfork. When we cornered the groom, he kept screaming stuff and nonsense about the Urgals and how he would never surrender. It wouldn't have done the fool any good even if he had. I struck him down with my own hand.
I'm sorry, said Nasawada.
The gems in Orin's crown glittered as he nodded in acknowledgement.
As painful as it is, you cannot allow your grief to dictate your decisions. It isn't easy, I know. Well, I know it. But you must be stronger than yourself, for the good of your people.
Be stronger than myself,
he said in a sour, mocking voice.
Yes, more is asked of us than of most people, Therefore we must strive to be better than most if we are to prove ourselves worthy of that responsibility. The Urgles killed my father, remember, but that did not prevent me from forging an alliance that could help the Varden. I won't let anything stop me from doing what is best for them and for our army as a whole, no matter how painful it might be.
She lifted her arms, showing him the scars again. That is your answer, then? You will not break off with the Urgles?
No.
Orin accepted the news with an equanimity that unsettled her. Then he gripped the sill with both hands and returned to his study of the city. Adorning his fingers were four large rings, one of which bore the royal seal of Cirda carved into the face of an amethyst, an antlered stag with sprigs of mistletoe wound between his feet, standing over a harp, and opposite an image of a tall, fortified tower.
At least, said Nasawada, we didn't encounter any soldiers who were enchanted not to feel pain.
The laughing dead, you mean, Orin muttered, using the term that she knew had become widespread throughout the Varden. Aye, and not Murtagh nor Thorn either, which troubles me.
For a time, neither of them spoke. Then she said, how went your experiment last night? Was it a success?
I was too tired to assay it. I went to sleep instead.
Ah.
After a few more moments, they both, by tacit agreement, went to the desk pushed against one wall. Mountains of sheets, tablets, and scrolls covered the desk. Nasawada surveyed the daunting landscape and sighed. Only half an hour earlier, the desk had been empty, swept clean by her aides. She concentrated upon the all-too-familiar topmost report, an estimate of the number of prisoners the Varden had taken during the siege of Bellatona, with the names of persons of importance noted in red ink. She and Orin had been discussing the figures when Ferica had arrived to remove her bandages.
I can't think of a way out of this tangle, she admitted.
We could recruit guards from among the men here. Then we wouldn't have to leave quite so many of our own warriors behind.
She picked up the report. Maybe, but the men we need would be difficult to find, and our spellcasters are already dangerously overworked.
Has Duvrangur Gata discovered a way to break an oath given in the ancient language? When she answered in the negative, he asked, have they made any headway at all?
None that is practical. I even asked the elves, but they have had no more luck in all their long years than we have had these past few days.
If we don't solve this, and soon, it could cost us the war, said Orin. This one issue, right here.
She rubbed her temples. I know.
Before leaving the protection of the dwarves in Farthen Dur and Trondheim, she had tried to anticipate every challenge the Varden might face once they embarked on the offensive. The one they now confronted, however, had caught her completely by surprise. The problem had first manifested itself in the aftermath of the Battle of the Burning Plains, when it had become apparent that all of the officers in Galbatorix's army, and most of the ordinary soldiers as well, had been forced to swear their loyalty to Galbatorix and the Empire in the ancient language. She and Orin had quickly realized they could never trust those men, not so long as Galbatorix and the Empire still existed, and perhaps not even if they were destroyed. As a result, they could not allow the men who wanted to defect to join the Varden, for fear of how their oaths might compel them to behave. Nasawada had not been overly concerned by the situation at the time. Prisoners were a reality of war, and she'd already made provisions with King Orin to have their captives march back to Cirda, where they would be put to work building roads, breaking rocks, digging canals, and doing other hard labor. It was not until the Varden seized the city of Feinster that she grasped the full size of the problem. Galbatorix's agents had extracted oaths of loyalty not only from the soldiers in Feinster, but also from the nobles, from many of the officials who served them, and from a seemingly random collection of ordinary people throughout the city, a fair number of whom she suspected the Varden had failed to identify. Those they knew of, however, had to be kept under lock and key, lest they try to subvert the Varden. Finding people they could trust then, and who wanted to work with the Varden, had proved far more difficult than Nasawada had ever expected. Because of all the people who needed to be contained, she had had no choice but to leave twice the number of warriors in Feinster as she had intended, and with so many imprisoned, the city was effectively crippled, forcing her to divert much-needed supplies from the main body of the Varden to keep the city from starving. They could not maintain the situation for long, and it would only worsen now that they were also in possession of Bellatona.
A pity the dwarves haven't arrived yet, said Orin. We could use their help.
Nasawada agreed. There were only a few hundred dwarves with the Varden at the moment. The rest had returned to Farthendur for the burial of their fallen king, Hrothgar, and to wait for their clan chiefs to choose Hrothgar's successor, a fact that she had cursed countless times since. She had tried to convince the dwarves to appoint a regent for the duration of the war, but they were as stubborn as stone, and had insisted upon carrying out their age-old ceremonies, though doing so meant abandoning the Varden in the middle of their campaign. In any event, the dwarves had finally selected their new king, Hrothgar's nephew Oric, and had set out from the distant Beor Mountains to rejoin the Varden. Even at that moment, they were marching across the vast plains just north of Cirda, somewhere between Lake Tudostin and the Jeet River. Nasawada wondered if they would be fit to fight when they arrived. As a rule, dwarves were hardier than humans, but they had spent most of the past 2 months on foot, and that could wear down the endurance of even the strongest creatures. They must be tired of seeing the same landscape over and over again, she thought. We have so many prisoners already, and once we take Drasleona, she shook her head. Appearing suddenly animated, Orin said, What if we bypass Drasleona entirely? He shuffled through the slew of papers on the desk until he located a large dwarf-drawn map of Alagasia, which he draped over the scarps of administerial records. The tottering mounds underneath gave the land an unusual topography. Peaks in the west of Dueldenvarden, a bowl-like depression where the Beor Mountains lay, canyons and ravines throughout the Hadarach Desert, and rolling waves along the northernmost part of the spine, born of the rows of scrolls below. Look! With his middle finger, he traced a line from Bellatona to the capital of the Empire, Urabane. If we march straight there, we won't come anywhere near Drasleona. It would be difficult to traverse the whole stretch all at once, but we could do it. Nasawada did not need to ponder his suggestion. She had already considered the possibility. The risk would be too great. Galbatorix could still attack us with the soldiers he has stationed in Drasleona, which is no small number if our spies are to be trusted. And then we'd end up fending off attacks from two directions at once. I know of no quicker way to lose a battle or a war. No, we must capture Drasleona. Orin conceded the point with a slight dip of his head.
We need our men back from Arrows, then. We need every warrior if we are to continue.
I know. I intend to make sure that the siege is brought to an end before the week is out.
Not by sending Aragorn there, I hope.
No, I have a different plan.
Good. And in the meantime, what shall we do with these prisoners?
What we have done before. Guards, fences, and padlocks. Maybe we can also bind the prisoners with spells to restrict their movement, so that we don't have to keep watch over them so closely. Other than that, I see no solution, except to slaughter the whole lot of them, and I would rather... She tried to imagine what she would not do in order to defeat Galbatorix. I would rather not resort to such drastic measures.
Aye.
Orin stooped over the map, hunching his shoulders like a vulture, as he glared at the squiggles of faded ink that marked the triangle of Bellatona, Drasleona, and Urubane. And so he remained, until Nasawada said, Is there anything else we must attend to? Jormunda is waiting for his orders, and the Council of Elders has requested an audience with me.
I worry.
What about?
Orin swept a hand over the map. That this venture was ill-conceived from the start. That our forces and those of our allies are dangerously scattered. And that if Galbatorix should take it in his head to join in the fight himself, he could destroy us as easily as Saphira could a herd of goats. Our entire strategy depends on contriving a meeting between Galbatorix, Aragorn, Saphira, and as many spellcasters as we can muster. Only a small portion of those spellcasters are currently among our ranks, and we won't be able to gather the rest into a single place until we arrive at Urubane and meet with Queen Islanzadi and her army. Until that happens, we remain woefully vulnerable to attack. We are risking much on the assumption that Galbatorix's arrogance will hold him in check until our trap has sprung shut around him. Nasawada shared his concerns. However, it was more important to shore up Orin's confidence than to commiserate with him, for if his resolve weakened, it would interfere with his duties and undermine the morale of his men. We are not entirely defenseless, she said.
Not any more. We have the Darthdert now, and with it I think we might actually be able to kill Galbatorix and Shrukan, should they emerge from within the confines of Urabane.
Perhaps.
Besides, it does no good to worry. We cannot hasten the dwarfs here, nor speed our own progress toward Urabane, nor turn tail and flee. So I would not let our situation trouble you excessively. All we can do is strive to accept our fate with grace, whatever it might be. The alternative is to allow the thought of Galbatorix's possible actions to unsettle our minds, and that I won't do. I refuse to give him such power over me.